Hi, I'm Ebony, and before we get started, I just want to take a moment to tell you about my five-day energy cleanse challenge. If you've been following me on Facebook, and if you've been listening to the podcast for the past few episodes, you've heard me talk already a lot about the five-day energy cleanse challenge, and I'm really excited because RSVP is open tomorrow, April 11th at zazo.com. This is a five-day virtual event in which I have five special guests from my podcast, and they will be teaching us strategies to help us heal emotionally, to help us tap into and take full advantage of our intuition, trust our intuition, to help us incorporate more play into our lives so that we can de-stress and really step into our courage. We have music therapist Noelle Anderson, who will be teaching us how we can use music to help heal. And we have wonderful Bridget Gaspard. She is a psychotherapist, and she'll be teaching us how to get unstuck in our lives by enlisting our inner selves, asking all those different personalities that reside within us to help us get unstuck. It's absolutely fascinating, and it works. So I am so excited about this event. If you can't already tell, be on the lookout. Also, I think the best way to get information is to sign up for my newsletter at zazo.com. You can also follow me on Facebook. I am so happy for transformation. And this is what this event is all about, transforming into the best version of ourselves so that we can touch other people's lives. They will see a difference in our lives and ask, what is happening? And the transformation just has this wonderful ripple effect. So be on the lookout. Five-day energy cleanse challenge at zazo.com. Okay, now let's get into the show with wonderful author Amy S. Peel. Here we go.
So anybody who wants to write or even put their toe in the water, know that's the truth, that the core and the anchor of who you are, there isn't another one of you.
Hi, I'm Ebony, and I believe that stories change lives, and everyone has a story worth telling. Sometimes, unfortunately, we let our self-doubt get in the way of us writing our stories and sharing our stories. So that's why I created Motivation to Write as a source of motivation and inspiration to help writers like you and me share our stories with the world. So I talk to the experts ranging from entrepreneurs to marketers to authors to therapists to psychologists who share their knowledge and their advice to help writers like you and me step into our full potential.
Amy S. Peel is a registered nurse and the award-winning author of Cut and Match, Medical Mysteries with a Mission and Side of Humor. Before becoming a writer, she enjoyed a 35-year career in the organ transplant field, providing an authentic backdrop to her books. Early in her medical career, she learned that humor was an essential survival skill and studied improvisation at Second City in Chicago. Amy Peel, I am so excited to have you. Thank you so much for being here with me on Christmas Eve.
Glad to be here. Why not start the holidays off with some fun?
Yes, exactly. And you, I know you have a lot of fun because you, I understand, know how to marry like serious topics with humor, which I'm interested to hear more about. You are an award-winning and best-selling author of a medical mystery series?
Yes, they're called Mysteries with a Mission and a Side of Humor.
Wow, I love that. Cut and Match.
Got it. You got it.
And what makes you even more interesting is that you've had over a three decades long career in organ transplant.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. All right. Well, first, let's start off with, I kind of want to hear a little about the medical. What came first, Amy? Let me ask that. What came first, the writing or the interest in medicine?
Medicine first. My mom was a nurse. I was raised by a single mom. There were six kids. She was a private duty nurse, so she raised us all. No dad, no child support, no anything. So I grew up as a kid. My mother always worked. There were no intensive care units, so she was a private duty nurse. So that's kind of where I started to watch. I didn't really want to be a nurse, honestly, but there you go. Right. Anyway, I became a nurse. I went to a two-year diploma program in South Chicago. And then I got to University of Chicago and I learned about transplants, kidney transplant patients. So we're in 1970, probably before a lot of people were born, but you know, I'm going to give them the D's. So I was 1977 and kidney transplants were just, you know, happening, but it was not yet what it is today. So that's where I got bit by the bug. And that catapulted me into a 35-year career, which was a very exciting career. And we can always talk about that if you have questions. And so I was living and breathing my, it turned out to be my passion. The one thing I thought, oh, I don't really want this job as a transplant coordinator. I think the universe has all our plans ready for us. We just don't know about it, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, I got into the field and it took me. And then much later in my career, although I like to write, I took some creative writing classes, which I didn't think I was a writer. Actually, I did The Artist's Way. Do you remember who Julia
was? Yes, yes, yes. That's a great book.
I was doing that with a bunch of friends and kept coming up writing. And I kept thinking, I'm not a writer. Why does this keep coming on? You know how they say, do a real quick list in 10 seconds, the top thing. And it came out on the page, but I really was not a writer. So I was like, well, all right, maybe I'll try. So I went to a community college, took a creative writing class with a very generous, loving, kind instructor who wanted to hear more. You know, I always wanted to write more in this wonderful storytelling environment. And those pockets are all over the world. So anyone who even doesn't think they are is curious, that's like a little landing pad for people. And it does, you know, sometimes it's free, sometimes community colleges don't cost much. So the writing, to answer your question, came after my career, and I was married and had kids and working, kind of landed in a creative space that I wasn't even aware I had, which I listened to that, you know?
Yeah, I
believe in that stuff. I think if you get quiet and ask questions, I think if you listen, you get information. So that's how my writing career started. And then I've been in a writing group of three other women for over 20 years. It's fun because I had a very serious job. I was a nurse and I talked to donor families when they were told their loved one wasn't going to live anymore. And I would ask them about organ and tissue donation. And if they said yes, so that being in that space with those people is probably the most sacred space where they've just been told that they lost somebody. And then I come in gently and ask them. And then if they do want their loved one to be a donor, I'm the one who organizes the whole thing, the operating room, the ICU and all that. So it's a very sacred space. And then on the other side of it, I get to pick up the phone too and say, hi, Susie, we have a kidney for you. People on the wait list, because there's lots of people waiting. I have a whole thing on my website where you can see how many are waiting and how many people. So that was my job. That was like my day-to-day job, being on call, talking to donor families, working with it. And so I did that for a long time, obviously, because you mentioned it in the intro. And finally, I was living in Chicago at the time. I was a single gal. And I thought I need some levity. So I sent myself to Second City's Players Workshop, which is an improv school. So at night, I got back in touch with what we all have, which is our imagination. We have it as kids. You know, when you watch kids and they make stuff up and they play and they all that. And
you were doing stand-up comedy?
I did. I got trained in improv.
Okay.
So we have to go all for a year. And then we did graduate on stage and we got to do a whole show at Second City, our class, which was like, what? But my point is that because we all get so serious as adults, right? And we all have to do things that maybe we do or don't want to do.
Yeah.
I found this place where I could just, they didn't know who I was. It wasn't important. It's not like I was, you know, a big movie star. And we just played with our imaginations because in improv, you get coaching. You know, it's yes and, yes and. So anytime you're playing, go make them tell that post that they just got, you know, they're going to be the king of England. Go. And you just, like, they give you stuff to play with. And my point is I started using the imagination that I had when I was a kid that we all had. Yeah. But it was fun and it was playful and it was light and it was silly.
Right.
So I graduated from Second City's Players Workshop and I was going to get invited to the second layer, but I got recruited out to San Francisco. So I found classes out here in improv, which for me were balancing the intensity of my transplant job, life and death, and finding some levity and imagination. Plus, I'm from a big family. I like to make people laugh. You know, I was the fifth of six kids, so you better have something going on if you're going to be, you know, part of that gang.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I love that. And plus, then I would just make fun of the doctors right in front of them. I would just get, and these are big old transplant surgeons are doing livers and kidneys and whatever. But when we weren't in the OR, you know, I got to learn how to play again. So I think opening up in my imagination and making it okay to be silly and light in the place where I'm also in a place at work that you can't be, you have to be. And then there's those pockets of time when you can play with people. I think everybody wants to play.
Yes.
I really do.
Yes.
I think it's part of us. So that's how I got the comedy and then started writing. And then when I decided, because I was director of a big transplant program, UCSF, University of California, San Francisco. We did about 600 solid organ transplants a year. So that's a lot of transplants, kidneys, livers, hearts, lungs. So I was the director for a long time. So I decided when I was going to retire, I wanted to kill the people I didn't like at work because some of them are real jerks. You know, and you know how you have to act normal sometimes, even though someone's saying stuff to you like, yeah, I can't even believe they're saying this here.
Right, yeah.
I parked them. So when I started writing my books, I just killed them, changed their name, their hair color, and made sure they were an organ donor. So I actually got my revenge. It's very cathartic for listeners, whoever, if they just hate somebody, come home, use your pen and paper, or get on the computer and delete it, but you got it out of you. So the second book, Match, that came out this year, I didn't realize how much I didn't like this one person. Because when I started writing, my hands were going to town. So, and I went to a lot of conferences. So anyway, marrying my passion with writing and having a little bit of fun with it, why not, is kind of the combo platter with my mystery series. And early on, I wrote a short memoir called Aunt Mary's Guide to Raising the Old Children the Old-Fashioned Way, which is a whole nother story, but it's a collection of short stories, and that was fun. That was in 2008. So those are just some quick sound bites. I know I'm like chattering away here, but
No, this is good because I want to go back and kind of revisit some stuff that you mentioned. The first thing I want to talk a little bit about is when you first took that class and went to the community college class to take a writing course, and you said that you didn't feel like a writer, did not identify as a writer. Was that because you had not published anything, or because you just didn't feel you did not have this skill set, or what was it about you?
I would say all of the above. I truly didn't believe. I was in my head, and we all have these gremlins or judgments about ourselves, myself. And I thought, all right, first of all, you know, I'm not a good speller. Secondly, you know, I haven't done a lot of, I like the more the self-help books and all that. I didn't read a ton of literature growing up. I read some. So in my head, I'm thinking, I'll never be able to write like those people. So why even bother? Right. Yeah. And so our teacher, Guy Biederman, would give us a word and it like ashtray, just a seed. And then you just write with it. And then you take it home, polish it, and bring it back. And that gave me like a sense of security. Plus I was in this room with like about 50 people. Some were 90, some were 20. Mm-hmm. And the stories that each of them had, that's their story. Like your story is your story. Mm-hmm. Nobody can tell it but you. And what I learned and listened to is hearing all these different people, laughter, thoughtful. I thought, okay, I'm going to show up. I'm going to write. And so little by little, I got some self-confidence to at least try.
Right.
I had a lot of judgment that I wasn't this, and I'm a nurse. Mm-hmm. I'm a this. Mm-hmm. I'm a mom. Right. I'm a that. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
There you go. I showed up.
You mentioned, you just said something really interesting. The other people in your class were great storytellers. So obviously you had this talent as a writer that you had not yet discovered, but I'm wondering, you didn't necessarily believe in the talent that you had not yet discovered, but were you a storyteller, maybe not a written word storyteller, but perhaps orally? Were you doing that when you were growing up or younger?
Yes. I totally got that. And I didn't, even when I was working, at one point I was telling one of the surgeons, we were going to visit some doctors, I was talking, and she just looked at me, bright, wonderful woman. She looked at me and she goes, "You're a storyteller."
Uh-huh.
And that was probably in my 30s, but even as a kid, I liked to listen to stories. And I think I also was a fifth or sixth kids, I watched a lot. And was, and I think observing and getting details down, and you know, watching good joke tellers. I would own that I was a storyteller. Not that I glued storyteller with writer together, right? I didn't. You know, that wasn't my world. That creative world of writing and all. My world was science and transplants and black and white, and you know, da 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 da. So I showed up and I wrote fun stuff, and my teacher just kept saying, "Tell me a little bit more about Aunt Mary," you know, because the word he gave us was ashtray. And my Aunt Mary, you know, she was a great Aunt Mary. She owned a brothel during the Depression. My grandmother apparently didn't, but obviously that was way before I was on board.
Yeah.
And anyway, she had property in Florida and in Indiana. And she did not suffer fools, okay? You didn't mess with Aunt Mary. And very smart businesswoman, good fisherwoman. Just, and I think as a kid, too, watching how we would go to Lake Wawasee every year for a couple weeks, which is outside of Indianapolis a little bit. And the stories, and we got to let just go free. We just got to run barefoot, jump in the lake, you know, those kinds of things. And I think, you know, I think all of us have this rich, wonderful source of stories and thoughts and ideas in us, and when we, if we stop and reflect, like I did at the community college, and write a little story showing someone the piece of my family, because Aunt Mary's ashtray literally was the size of an end table. It was ceramic, it was red, and everybody in smoked because that was what everybody did. So when he said ashtray, I in my head I thought everybody had an Aunt Mary that had a bunch of people smoking and had an ashtray the size that you could bathe a small child in, right? You know how you're a kid and you think that's your world, so it must be everybody else's? Why wouldn't everyone have a great Aunt Mary, you know?
She outfitted
the garage or the bathroom with drinks. If you were a good friend of hers, she would have your liquor and your cigarettes ready in the garage that was carpeted and was great, because if she was tired of you, she'd go in her house. But you would never have to leave for what you wanted to drink or eat. That's kind of how I would, that's our summers. So I just thought everybody had those big ashtrays at their house, right? And had, you know, a great Aunt Mary. And so when I wrote about it, he goes, my teacher goes, "Tell me a little bit more about Aunt Mary."
I love that, because I was talking to an author recently, and we were talking about teaching writing, particularly to younger people, and how a lot of younger people just don't believe that they can write or that they are writers, because they, similar to you, I don't read that much. I hate reading. I'm not good with spelling. I'm not good with my sentences, blah, blah, blah. But they are really good storytellers and they don't even realize it. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to grow up to be a writer, but I mean, storytelling is definitely what writing is about. And she said she was helping this man write his PhD on something about water. I can't remember exactly, but he was stuck. He's like, I'm stuck on this thesis. What do I do? And she said, okay, well, what's your main character? Who's your main character? He said, I don't have a main. This is nonfiction. I'm writing a thesis on water. She said, no, water is your character. And what is water doing? Water. And he was talking about how water, like the hydraulic system or whatever cycle. And there was a whole story that he was writing. He didn't even know it. He said, and she said, once he understood that his main character was writer.
Wow.
And the conflict that writer, that the water was confronting in its journey through this hydraulic cycle, whatever he was writing about, it came to him. Like the thesis just flowed from there.
Wow.
So it's amazing how we overlook the main element of writing, which in many cases is you're telling a story. Even if you're writing a letter to someone, a thank you letter, I mean, you're telling the story of how what they did for you and how happy you are for whatever they did, right?
Right.
But yeah. It's,
and it's, that's brilliant. How, what a great shift on that, that what a gift that was for him to kind of help him reposition that, because it is, it's like, we're all storytellers. We all have the life we are living and have lived. Nobody has lived that but us, each person. So when people say, there's a lot of books out there, murder mysteries, there's a lot of books, memoirs. I've learned, and I'm with really wonderful people who write and teach writing, is no one will write your story but you. Mm-hmm. Nobody lives inside of your mind and your body and has had your life. Nobody. Mm-hmm. So anybody who wants to write or even put their toe in the water, know that's the truth, that the core and the anchor of who you are. There isn't another one of you. There isn't another one of me, thank God. And, so no one's going to write the little memoir I wrote or my murder mysteries because I lived it. So when people read like Cut or Match, they go, I feel like I kind of really got to see what goes on behind the curtain. Because mm-hmm. you do. Mm-hmm. So, and that, I didn't really want to write about it because I lived it for so long. I wanted to write like a light, silly, bunko murder mysteries, da 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 da. And I remember hearing Michael Conley speak because I live outside of San Francisco, and the Court of Madeira has Book Passage, which is awesome. Anyway, he was speaking and I'm sitting in the front row like a big nerd. And then he had a patient who had a heart transplant in his book. And so I went up to him afterwards, like, I'm, you know, starstruck. I go, oh, nice to meet you. I'm in transplant, but you know, I don't want to write about it. And he just looked at me, goes, that's too bad. And then he just, you know, cause they say, write what you know.
Yeah.
Well, I kept pushing. Finally, when I just said, okay, then that's when the book's ideas for Cut, which was, but can you buy your way to the top of a liver transplant list, and Match, which is about kidney transplants, opioid crisis. I did kill a politician, just full disclosure. I didn't kill him. His disease did. It's clear. Anyway, so that's how it opened, another opening. Because I think the universe, people, whatever you believe in, think you get signs, you get messages.
Yes, yes.
Somebody told you that you should start a podcast. Something inside of you has got this curiosity and this lust for learning, is my guess. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. you knew that. Mm-hmm. So to embark on putting a podcast together is no light lift. And
right, yeah.
Congratulations to you for doing it.
Well, thank you. And I think I love this point because I do believe that we are always getting messages from conversations that we have, things we overhear on television or the radio or people we just happen to run into. I mean, there was always something there for us to take and run with if we choose to do so. I mean, even this encounter, you said Michael Crichton, right? The coma.
Michael Conley.
Conley. Okay.
He's kind of a big deal too in the mystery world.
Yeah.
But
even so, I mean, for you to be in this front row at his author talk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hello. Like, there's just, and I love once something you also brought up earlier was how you felt the need to inject some levity in your life, and you chose stand or improvisation. I like how you made that choice. Like, you recognize that you were in this very serious, can be very sad sometimes, career, and you purposely chose something that probably wasn't easy for you to do, like get up in front of people and act. I just love that because it demonstrates the power that comes with stepping into the unknown.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's scary. Mm-hmm. You know, I later on, after I retired, I went to the Chopra Center and I got my certification. I took a bunch of classes and it was wonderful, but I got certified to teach yoga, which I thought, well, you know, like, you can't tell, but I'm a tall gal. I'm a full figured gal. And mm-hmm. I love yoga. I've taken yoga, but I never thought someone like me could teach yoga, even though I love classes. And I got certified in yoga, and it was chair at the time because I had my knees weren't great, and I learned, it's all mat. You learn on the mat, but you can teach anywhere. And I thought, wow, I like this stuff. Well, anyway, you take all these prereqs and yada yada. So they did announce at one of them that there was going to be a talent show. So I thought, well, maybe I should go for it. So I told them, and so I did a 3-minute stand up in front of 200 people I had never met at the Chopra Center. I mean, they were in classes with me, but you know, I didn't know them. And I decided that what I was going to do is give Deepak Chopra his evaluation, and that I was going to be the universe, and I was going to tell, because I was in healthcare, I was a manager, you have to give people their performance. So I asked the people who organized, I said, this is my thinking. They said, yeah, yeah. So I decided I was going to say, Deepak, now, everybody gets an annual evaluation. We're going to talk about a few things, but you need to stay here. And I just played with the meditation and the stuff that we, you know, we learned and stuff. And I it was scary. Like, to your point, it was a risk. And I practiced and practiced by myself. And I'm in my room. I didn't even tell my family I was doing this. They weren't even there. I just thought, okay. And it was called, the conference was called Seduction of Spirit, go figure. these people came up to me after and they go, do you do that for a living? And I was like, no way. I mean, because, you know, you really, just for 3 minutes, it's like, you know, but I knew the content I was with. But it was fun, and I'm glad I took the risk, because that was like such a great fun and spot. I got a lot of like people coming up going, you were really good. You should be stand-up. And doing stand-up is really a lot of work. You know, you gotta, you get a laugh or you don't get a laugh, but so anyway, I did stretch for that one. I really jumped on it and got scared. I think when you feel a little scared, it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. If you're just doing everything you're doing all the time, you don't push yourself a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think it's a good thing to just put your toe in something you don't really know, or go on an artist date with yourself to a place you don't, you know, maybe a museum, or maybe you'll go to a restaurant you've never eaten and just have some casual coffee and watch people. The assignments that we get for creative writing, you know, they would say, go to a coffee shop and don't just listen, like eavesdrop to conversation if you're learning on dialogue and see how people interrupt each other. And we just got all these really fun little assignments from the community college to write, like to listen. Mm-hmm. And I just love that, because then when you have that in you, like once I knew I was going to write the murder mystery series, even when I was at work, I was listening differently. Because I was like, how would I explain to these doctors sitting around this table? Like, what would, if you've never been in a, like a selection meeting where we decide who gets on the list and who doesn't, and you've never seen anything about transplant, how could I show you what it was like to be in that room? Who was sitting around the table? How did we talk? You know, what was it like? So that was like another layer of consciousness where that was just my job that I did with the team. But now if I have to explain it to an outsider, how do I look at that differently? Mm-hmm. And it was kind of cool, actually, because the scenes in my books reflect, you know, they say show, don't tell, which, you know, is good. Meaning I want to show you, I don't want to tell you. And that's what, you know, good writing does, is you tell them the story, as, and once you've got them, bringing them in, they're like in, and they're, because you're showing them what this feels like or tastes like or smells like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So all the little ingredients over time, I think, make up.
So when you decided, well, when did you decide that you wanted to really publish a book?
I would say, well, I did publish the memoir in 2009, Aunt Mary's Guide. It was for my, I had a book coach, which was great, Brooke Warner, who's amazing, who actually was an acquisition editor for a press and realized so many women's stories were not getting picked up. So about 8 or 9 years ago, she started a woman's only press called She Writes Press. It's just for women, because she found that so much good, so many good stories were in the world and they weren't getting picked up. So they're winning a lot of awards, their memoirs. It's amazing. So anyway, I had her level of coaching support. And I had a collection of short stories because I was working full time at the Park Your Life at the Door job. So I pulled out the stories I'd written at the community college, one about the ashtray, and I had written some other ones. And over time, she helped me polish them. And fine. So she knew that world to navigate. And she helped me with the cover. I got it self-published. It's still selling today. And my mom was alive at the time. And it was a gift too, because it wasn't, you know, it was a tough childhood, I'm not going to lie. And part of me just wanted to write about the fun stuff.
Right.
When I wrote the first draft of what I thought was done, and I met a girl, a woman who was a psychologist who's now a good friend. She says, why are these children so anxious to get to the lake and jump in the water? What was going on at home? And I was just like, yeah, I don't really want to write those stories. But the good news is she had a memoir writing class. I was in a supportive world. It was very healing, because memoir, writing your own story, whether you put it out there or not, if you've had any kind of trauma, it's very healing for your soul. The stories inside of me were the size of like a big basketball, but once I wrote them out, they were probably the size of a golf ball. Mm. So I got, like you said before, I got to the right place with the right people. And then I wrote the selection of stories, and my mom and I did a little book tour. I wasn't just going to write it for the family, but we did a little book tour in Chicago and at the lake and here out here. People loved it. You know, I wrote about, you know, a bunch of short stories that are then cohesed. So that was 2009. And then after that, I was in a writing, I've been in a writing group, and I love mystery. So I went to conferences, murder mystery writing conferences, and we have a good bookstore here. So they have a whole crowd of really good authors, and I could just go and listen and learn and plot and, you know, just be surrounding yourself with the people that you want to be part of, even if you don't know them. So you're like key, could be community college, or even if you go to a bookstore and you say, I want to write something about cooking, and you can go and just look at all the books and look at them. It might not be like for the one you would write, but you can just visit them. So I would go and look at the mysteries, and, you know, I would be at mystery conferences, and, you know, I knew I wasn't a mystery writer yet, but put yourself around those people. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was noticing when you were talking. You had a book coach. Now, earlier you mentioned writing groups. You were part of writers groups. And then you went to conferences. So you were always positioning yourself around the industry, really the people in the industry, which that just kind of positions you for opportunities.
Right. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So with the first book, which I published with She Writes Press, I got an agent. I got a literary agent. Now, I never thought I was, again, I have, in our world, and you probably have them too, gremlins. We talk about the like negativity stuff that can come up when you're doing something, going like, you know, who do you think you are? You're not a writer. You know?
So we go imposter syndrome, they call that.
Yeah. What do you call it?
Imposter syndrome.
Exactly. Imposter. Yeah. Well, my friend Betsy and I, she's a writer as well. She and I named them. So my name, my gremlin's name is Ursula. And hers is Dominique. And so when I'm really in that space where I'm like, forget it, I can't do this, what were you thinking? I just call. I said, Betsy, Ursula wants to talk to you. Mm-hmm. And we know it's not real. Okay. So if there's any people worried about our mental condition, we're good to go. But Betsy will go, put her on. Like, it's like your biggest yelling at her and acknowledging it and then moving past it. Like, okay, you had your opinion. Now I'm going to go ahead and write my book. And one of the tricks I learned early on from my coach, Sarah Cannell, because I think we need help. I don't think anyone does anything solo, my guess. Mm-hmm. She tells you, take a book, take any book you want, and then just take the cover and of what you think your book's going to look like and wrap it around the book. Even though this inside wasn't initially but mentally, let's say that, you know, the next book I have is going to be Hold, and it's not, I'm writing it now, but Match wasn't written, but I had the cover on it. I have it on my writing desk. So when I'm writing, my brain says, oh, you already got that book done. It's like a little fun thing to do, because your brain only picks up what you're feeding it. You know, you have thoughts, you're whatever. So one of the tricks was, and I do it to this day for the third book, I have the cover on it. I'm still writing it. There's not in there, but the first two books, Match and Cut, I just mocked up what, and I never knew these were going to be the cover pictures because we weren't that far, but I wrote the name of it. I wrote the name of it on the spine and I put it on my writing desk, and I'll show you, but you know, this is a podcast, so nobody could see the new cover because this is on the down low. Okay. This is what the new cover is going to look like for the third book.
Oh, okay.
But that's not the third book inside.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So I have that sit up by my desk when the days when I have, and this is just like evidence. This is book's going to get done. I mocked up the thing like I did all the other ones. And it worked. I mean, that's not the only thing. You still have to show up and write and edit and do. But there's little fun things, tricks and trips, if you have a lot of gremlins or imposter syndromes that, you know, you can really employ to keep yourself in the game and write. Like one of the things when I was working, I didn't have time to write a lot. So I made the password for my work email, my computer, the name of one of my characters. Mm-hmm. So every time I entered it, which was a lot because of, you know, day-to-day work, I was thinking about her. Mm-hmm. Even though I couldn't do much else, just writing, giving a password name to a character or story, whatever's coming up for people that want to write. It's like a little touch. And you make enough of those little things, it's feeding that part of your creative mind that might not get that outlet at work because you might be in a real, it's a fun thing to do. So, I mean, I've learned a lot from lots of different coaches about how to reward myself. There's this thing, my coach, Sarah Cannell, I made a list of a few things that I want to make sure, you know, I shared them if it's okay with you and your listeners.
Yeah.
There's this thing called pleasure bundling. And it's from an article of Freakonomics. You're shaking your head. Yes.
Oh my gosh! I read the Freakonomics book. They used to have a podcast too. I don't know if they still do, but
I don't know. So Sarah made. I did a boot camp with her. She's an amazing writing coach and thought leadership academy. She's the jam. Mm. Anyway, in it, there's this pleasure bundling thing. Meaning, I don't want to write, but when I do write, I get to, go for a walk, have a cup of tea. You know, do something that brings me joy. So even if at first I don't want to get in the room and sit down, that's probably the biggest thing is getting in that chair.
Yeah.
Once I get in the chair and I'm writing, I'm like, yeah, okay. But then my brain is, and then I get something, whatever that something, it might be a sweet treat. It might be like, and it doesn't have to be food or drink or anything. It could be whatever brings your heart joy. Maybe a yoga class, maybe a nap, maybe some funny thing on Netflix. Doesn't matter. When you start coupling that with something pleasurable, eventually your brain just melds them, and you know it's pleasurable to show up and sit and write. Even though if I want to give myself a treat, and I do some days, it was a good idea to kind of play with my energies in a way and to get through the doubt, you know, the doubt stream sometimes.
So
that was just one. The password I wanted to mention in the pleasure bundling too, and then the covering your book. Those are just a couple little things. You know, we all have our little toolkit of how we get where we get each way. And like you were saying earlier, listening, surrounding yourself, even if you have imposter syndrome, nobody knows when you go to the bookstore, when you're staring at books or looking at things that they don't know who you are.
Right.
Like, you know, what the heck? Who cares? Right. I know I'm older, so who does care? You know, at some point, it's great not to worry about that anymore. But so I think just little field trips for yourself, just to give yourself, or even nature. You know, if anyone really has a story in them they want to tell, or they're, you know, they have some book in them, or they may have a speech or a TED talk in them, just to go somewhere and reflect and let it go. Like, let your mind just have the space to believe that you could possibly do that.
Right.
You know,
I like all those little exercises, like the book cover, the password, they're like little subconscious muscle builders. Just to kind of plant the seed to really kind of bind whatever is happening in the brain so that it kind of feels and believes, like you said, that this is actually happening for you.
Yeah. And it works. I mean, I'm on my fourth book, and I'm going to be writing a romantic comedy after this for my agent wants a romantic comedy. So I'm like, why not? And I've already outlined it and stuff. And there's techniques and just finding like a good coach or someone who could show you the way. Like, there's good how-to books and stuff out there. But the other thing is that, I've learned and do is what I call a power hour. And it's what it is. It's like, I commit to you to meet you 3 times a week or 4 on, we do it on Zoom now. And it's usually 1.5 to 2 hours. We show up, there's a group of us writers or other thought leaders, and we commit. So I'd say, well, I'm just going to work on my submission 7 for my editor today. And we each declare, I declare. So I need to be accountable to you. It's easier. I don't want to disappoint you. So I might not feel like showing up that day, right? But I don't want to not show up for you. Sometimes it's like, you know, you need that exercise partner, right? You know, it's too cold. I'm not walking. Oh, she's outside. I better get my coat on, right? Mm-hmm. So we do these power hours as accountability, making an appointment with ourselves and also showing up. So we're all on screen. We declare, it's no like chit chat talk, how's the weather, what'd you eat for dinner, yada, yada, none of that. Then we turn our cameras off and we just work. Turn our cameras and our sound off. We work on whatever that project is. And it's actually, been a huge game changer for me to just stay on track. And I think those are good little things. If you really want to write or you want to do something and you have someone who believes in you, well, would you want to like meet me at the coffee shop? Or if we can't go out because of COVID, or then how about we get online together, even if it's FaceTime or Zoom? Mm-hmm. And it's like you're in the room with people who are also working towards their next project. And I think, mm-hmm. and it's the accountability mm-hmm. too.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think just owning that and connecting with and finding some accountability partners, I think is huge.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think that surrounding yourself with people who are going to inspire you and hold you accountable versus people who are going to feel maybe threatened by what you're doing or are going to discourage you. Because if you're surrounded by people like that, just forget it.
Right.
I was talking to a psychotherapist about a year ago, and she was saying that a lot of us are scared of success because when you are stepping into that new power, you are like, you have to kind of assume a new persona. And the people, your inner circle, they sometimes don't like this new persona. It is not that you're a jerk or an asshole. Like, that's not the persona to assume if you are trying to pursue pursuit. But you just feel a lot more confident and powerful and maybe a little bit more assertive. And a lot of people are scared to step into that because they don't want to lose the people that are close to the, or, you know, or might leave them because now you're someone a bit different. So it's really important to have those people around you who are just going to be like, yes, yes. As you grow, they grow. They grow.
Right. And sometimes when you do that, and you know that they're thinking, well, if she can do this, you know,
yeah,
if she can start a podcast, if she can, maybe I could. Yeah. But that's scary for people who don't even want to go down like that little alley to open up the door and get in. But, you know, I really think when we find the courage to do those things and turn down the negative stuff and the, oh, I don't want to lose my friendships or my family. Even when I was writing the memoir, my family was like, stop writing those stories. You shouldn't write those stories. I'm like, I'm writing the stories. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mom says it's fine. I'm writing the stories. And they used to say, oh, the car wasn't yellow. I had the negative stuff. I'm surprised I ever got the thing written because yeah. it wasn't perfect. Like maybe the car was light blue. I remember I was eight. I probably thought it was blue. Who knew light blue from dark blue? I just blew, right? So I think you're right. You surround yourself with that. And if you don't know people that like, you know, maybe are going down the path that you want to go to, mm-hmm. remember success leaves clues. And if you look at any writer, any speaker, anybody who does anything well and check them out and read about them, they've left clues.
Mm-hmm.
They've done things like we're talking about, right? They've figured out like how to get themselves to a place where they're willing to live that dream or step on that stage or do this mm-hmm. thing. Because anyone who's successful, you know this, it just didn't happen overnight.
Right.
It did not happen for, and most good artists, storytellers, actors, anybody will tell you so. There's no such thing as an overnight success for anybody, mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm. And so I think for all of us creatives in the world to know that, you know, reach out, you know, look at your favorite author, singer, actress, actor, director, speaker, whatever, and just see how they are. Like, what? There's so much media you can do. Like, you know, I saw David Sedaris live about a month ago, and that guy's just, he has got his own imagination. It's bigger than what, and he's funny, he's poignant. You know, just to take yourself to a place to listen to that piece of music or dance or listen to the author and just sprinkle seed. All that stuff, it'll come, you know, marinate it.
Amy, because really what you're talking about here is confidence. Confidence, because you have to have confidence to achieve a level of success, but confidence does not come naturally for most people. I mean, that's something you have to practice. And when you mentioned like watching people who you admire and, you know, see how they hold themselves and how they, and when they're in front of a crowd, what do they do? That they practice that too, for sure, I'm sure, over years and years and years. Because I think you're right. A lot of times we look at people and we think, oh my gosh, they're famous. And we think they were an overnight success and that this just happened super quickly for them. But if you really listen to their story very carefully, you will see that this journey started for them at age 5 or at age 17 or whatever. And so I think that if we would let go of this obsession with quickness, like everything has to happen like that. Yes. And yeah, and if we don't have, if we feel like we just don't have the confidence to achieve something, that it's just hopeless for us. No, because you can practice the confidence and learn the confidence.
You can. And even today, when I still send my next submission to my editor, a developmental editor I work with on my books to help the story stay going where it is, it's so weird because I have 2 good books that won awards. They're bestsellers. The latest one got an Amazon bestseller in April. I was like, what?
Wow.
That is good. But I still send it to my editor for the next book. And I'm thinking, oh God, what if it's crap? And I mean, like, it's not like this one's not going away. It's just like, but I have assembled some evidence over the years. Now I'm 68, okay? But over the years that I actually did published 3 books already and that they have done well. So, but it didn't happen overnight, like you said, you know, and it's scary. It's not like, I mean, when I first was sending the first manuscript out, I was ready to throw up, like, oh, what do you do when they're just going to tear you apart? Yeah. But go figure.
You know, I was listening to, what is he? He's another psychologist. And he was talking about how we are so, it's not that we're necessarily scared to do things that we think we're scared to do. So, oh my gosh, I can't do stand up because I'm just scared to get in front of people. No, he says, what you're really scared of is the feeling of the fear in you. Like, you don't want to feel it in your body. We don't want to feel the pain. We don't want to feel the embarrassment. We don't want to feel the whatever. So to avoid the feeling, we avoid doing it.
Yes.
And so you would just get comfortable with feeling a little uncomfortable, then you can start to melt away those inhibitions and start to take action. But we get stuck because we don't want to feel it.
And they say when you're a little uncomfortable or scared, it's actually a good thing that you're getting out of your comfort zone.
Yes, yeah.
So if people want to take the challenge, they can know. You still can go back and wrap yourself in the blanket in the bed and go, okay, I did it all, you know. Yeah. But give yourself credit for having the thought to want to do it and to just find a couple good friends who are going to hold your hand and be there when you get back, even if it was a bust. I mean, you know, look at the stand-up comedians. They don't all get laughs all the time. Well, you know what I mean? They're quiet. Like, I listened to this really funny podcast, and it's called Smart Less, and it's with Jason Bateman and Will Arnett and another guy. But they interview everybody from Paul McCartney to Kamala Harris to – you name it, authors and everybody. And like they just did, what's his face, Seinfeld and then Jimmy Fallon. Yeah, they do everybody. The point is you feel like you're at the kitchen table. And what you hear from every single interview is their process. And it was not open the door, I got the job, I'm a movie star.
Right.
Or I'm a stand-up. You know, Seinfeld was saying, you have to work the material. And you show up and if there's no laughter, it doesn't work. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I gravitate towards those kinds of things to hear people's story and how they got where they got. Cause I love those kinds of stories. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, even the gal who wrote Henrietta Lacks, Rebecca Skloat, I got to hear her live, you know, and her book was a huge success.
Right.
And she said 4 years she was couch surfing. She had little index cards, like the size of an index card, all over her apartment, trying to figure out how to put the thing together, this book. 4.5 years it took her to do the research, no money, quit her job, did it. She was determined to get the story. And the family didn't want to tell the story. And she dug and dug. And finally, she got the story written. And, you know, there's a movie and everything.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And she said, people would say, oh, how does it feel to be an overnight success? She goes, no, I slept on a lot of couches. I ate a lot of ramen, you know? Mm-hmm. So success leaves clues. Mm-hmm. And I'd say anybody who really just wants to try it, and even if you don't want to tell anybody, you can just go, maybe I want to try to paint or draw or, you know, all that. Just, it's like, why not? We're only here once, right?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can show up like you but you. Mm-hmm. As my daughter has said, my daughter's a farmer and a butcher in Eugene and has a cooking school that she fixed to feed people because she feels life happens around the table and that's what's most important, is to have a meal with people and stuff. She just says to me, Mom, just do you. Do you, Mom? And I'm thinking, yeah, okay. I still think I'm going to scare a couple people, but, you know, I'm just doing me. I'm doing right. me and mix, you know. I have like a storyboard. I cut the pictures of my characters out from People magazine as if I was going to have a movie, the book. So when I'm writing, I look up at the pictures and say, well, there's Sarah Golden or there's Jackie Larson, of course.
That's a great idea.
And it's, you know, your crew wouldn't be able to see it on the podcast, but I have my whole cast, want me to show you real quick, of who I would put in the movie. If and when, and you can always say if and when, you don't know, the crazier things are happening. But what I do is I keep my storyboard here. So I have my characters who I cast in the third book.
Wow.
And I talk to them. And I mean, and when I'm in here writing alone and I get stuck, I'd say, well, what would, you know, Victor? Oh, he is something, this Victor Botswell.
Which one?
This guy here.
He's
the character, one of my main characters in the third book.
Oh.
Not a nice guy.
That guy is on Wire, right? Wired or The Wire?
Yeah, Idris Elba.
Yes. Okay, that's his name. Okay. Yes.
But anyway, so I have my characters, my two main best friend characters. Sarah Golden is Sarah Silverstein, and then Jackie Larson is Melissa McCarthy. And these are some of the characters in the third book. But I make them. It's kind of a fun little artist date. You just go through and go, if I was going to write a story fiction, who would I want to cast in the movie? So I do that too. It's just something fun because then I have a visual, like, and if I'm trying to describe to you the color of their hair, how tall they are, facial things, I'm a visual learner. So I like to fix, you know, who the hell knows if Netflix is going to buy, they might get in a war with Hulu for this series. You just don't
exactly
making it up. But yeah. And then the other little thing I have is my friend Betsy gave me these, it's an elephant. And you know what they say, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, one word at a time, one sentence at a time. Even if you don't have time and you want to do a 1 minute, show up at your desk and write one sentence, you wrote. You wrote for the day. If you're working full time, raising the kids, whatever, at least you showed up and you wrote something. So how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Every story, every book, every movie, everything happens a little at a time, like we were saying. It just doesn't, the movie's just not done. The book's not just done. So I think remembering and stepping back, because my friend also has a podcast and she's called The Morning Glory Project, and she interviews all these people who made it through these horrible situations. And I said, well, what have you, you know, Betsy, what have you taken away? And she goes, they all did it. Some survived and they just did it one step at a time. There's no broad stroke to this. These people had tenacity. They had terrible life experiences and they got through and thrived.
Wow.
So, you know, when you're saying surround yourself with content and, you know, and real life stories and testimonies and things that make a difference in people's lives, I really believe there's so much good out there. And there's so much, and people want to help. Like when I was going to these writing conferences, I'd be like, there's that author. Oh my God. Louise Penny. I've met her in person 3 times. She's a big, famous, she's a Canadian writer. She just co-wrote a mystery with Hillary Clinton. She's just lovely. But what she said in an interview, and I actually met her in person because she came for a book tour here. When I told her, I just wrote my first mystery, she just looked at me, international bestselling author, said, go get your book. We'll take a picture. But she's got a line of people that are waiting to get their book signed. I went and got my book. I met her. I met her again. She was so, but she said when she wrote her very first book, she was a journalist in Canada.
I'm sorry, Amy. Oh my gosh. Okay. This is so embarrassing. Oh my
God. Music.
I'm going to pause just one moment. That's for Zoom. Sorry about that.
So Louise Penny, when I heard her in an interview, said, I wrote a book. I didn't know anyone would want to read it or buy it or like it. So I wrote a book. I made up a place I wanted to be in with characters I wanted to hang out with and in a story that I liked. And if nobody bought one book, at least I enjoyed the process and enjoyed creating. And I thought, I like it. because then you know, she didn't, obviously she's amazing, but she did, when she started, she would say, I only had one person come to my book talk. Now she's this international best-selling author. You see advertisements on the TV for her. She just bought her series now, but she's as gracious and loving and kind. And I do believe when you go and show up and surround yourself with people, and even if you're like nervous, you know, because, you know, we live in a place where some of these, there's some fancy, you know, like Carlos Santana was shopping for CDs back when the kids were, but we were in a bookstore and, you know, he's just sorting through and buying stuff. And my kids went over and just said hi because we love music in their house. And he was just lovely. He was very gracious and kind. And, you know, it's so, I think people do want to help and they do want to support. And I think if any, you know, because getting people from the, I want to do it to the first step, try it. Don't get scared. It's okay. Go buy yourself a soda or pop after, or try this. Yes. Leave some breadcrumbs for yourself. It's okay. You can do this. Having that, you know, like these little buckets of things that might nurture them, nurture their creativity. Mm-hmm. I think they can get there. I know that. I mean, it works, you know, I think.
Wow. Ah, this has been such a great conversation, Amy. And I did go over 40 minutes. I always go over 40 minutes, but that's okay because there's so much great stuff here. I'm going to give you the opportunity to tell us where we can find you.
Okay. I have a website, amyspeele.com. I'm having a big contest right now, Match Around the World. Anybody who gets the book and takes a picture from wherever they are wins beautiful fused glass necklace. My husband makes glass necklaces. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal. You kind of want the necklace. I'm going to tell you. So if you go to my website, amyspeele.com, you'll see my contest. You'll also see my books if you want to read a chapter for free. And if you can't afford it, you can always have your library order the book for you, because why not use our libraries? And I always support independent bookstores because they're a dying breed. And so if you have an independent bookstore that you could order the book from, and if you don't know it, you just go to my website and there's an IndieBound button and you put in your zip code and it'll find the local independent bookstore in your neighborhood. So those are just some things. And just take good care of yourself. Sign your organ donor card or tell your family what you want to do, because I always think that's important. Whether you want to or not is okay. Just let people know. And enjoy life, because I'll tell you, there's a lot of people in my career who didn't have the opportunity I saw firsthand. And I have a lust for life because of the patients and families I got to be with and see what matters. And I tell you, we are all gifted with our life. Have fun with it. Be creative with it. Go for the gusto. Embarrass yourself. Laugh out loud. What the heck?
Love it. Thank you so much, Amy. I'm going to stop recording, but I'm just going to chat with you for a moment.
Amy is such a delightful person to talk to. I don't think I've laughed as much during an interview as I did with her interview, because she's just so humorous. And she has so many wonderful nuggets of wisdom. Oh my goodness. I loved the conversations about stepping outside of your comfort zone, about practicing confidence, about trying something new, even though you might think that you can't do it, because you never know unless you first try it. And it's just so inspiring. So please check out Amy's website and obviously check out her books, because I think that her journey is so extraordinary, but at the same time, I think reflects a lot of our journeys, where we start off with an interest in a particular field. Like, she started off with an interest in medicine, and then through that interest, it leads you to something else that you never even considered, that you never even thought that you would really become wonderful in. And for her, that was writing. So yes, such an inspiring story. I'm kind of just getting excited all over again talking about it. But check out her website, check out her books. And I also hope to see you on April 18th, which is coming up soon, for my 5-day energy cleanse challenge, so that we can begin to step into that courage and that power by clearing away some of the energetic and emotional clutter that's been holding us back. I have some fabulous guests for this energy cleanse challenge, and I really do hope to see you there. In the meantime, check out my social media. You can follow me on Facebook at Motivation to Write, and also Motivation to Heal. I'm also on Instagram at Motivation to Write, and I'm on Twitter at Ebony Haywood. And of course, sign up for my newsletter at zazo.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I will see you next week when I talk to another fabulous guest. Okay, bye-bye.